6.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the tiny village of Fort Rae in Canada's Northwest Territories, the Dog Rib Indians still trap muskrat and lynx. In the winter, they run nets under the ice. And it's so cold, the fish actually freeze solid before they asphyxiate. The jackfish are stacked like cordwood outside the tiny cabins and fed to the dogs, whole. Some years back, in the pale light of an Arctic winter afternoon, a young Dene man took me to meet his father. I had a tape recorder. As the father spoke, the son translated. I remember the old man's face, dark copper color, deeply lined and sandpapered by years outside. He told stories of the trap line and some of the legends that he'd been told. It was a wonderful afternoon for a young radio reporter until I stopped recording and rewound the cassette a bit to check that I had the interview. When the old man heard the sound of his voice, he started in horror. His gentle face turned angry, and he started shouting at his son. The young man argued back that his father was so enraged, so we quickly pulled on our parkas and boots, and we left. Later, the son explained that one old belief of the Dog Rib is that spoken words go out into the air, but they never disappear, that the words themselves have a life. And bad words, spoken years ago, still follow the speaker around. The father was angry because he believed I had tricked him, imprisoning his words in the little black box that was my tape recorder. It's the sort of lesson that is already very well understood by my guest this hour. Wade Davis has traveled the world studying Aboriginal people. He is an ethnobotanist and an anthropologist, a writer of many articles and books, and is currently explorer in residence with National Geographic. How do you get a job like that? He also calls himself an ethnologist. He studies people in their place, looking at languages and worldviews. Now, one of his questions, Connection listeners, is, can the disappearance of such Aboriginal people be prevented? Is the diversity of dialect and lifestyle an inevitable sacrifice to our technologically advancing world? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Wade Davis is my guest this hour. He has a new book. It's called Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. And in fact, if you want to look at some of the fabulous photographs from that book, you can do that as you listen to the program by going to our website at theconnection.org. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dick.
You think about diverse cultures. You begin thinking about them in the book in terms of language, that is in a way that we or you identify them.
Well, you know, I think that your anecdote from Northern Canada was so apropos because it really does illustrate the great revelation of anthropology, and that is the idea that the world in which we live in doesn't exist in some absolute sense, but is by definition just one model of reality, the consequence of one particular set of adaptive choices that our lineage made, albeit successfully, many generations ago. But if there's one revelation of anthropology, it's our other ways of thinking, other ways of being, other ways of orienting yourself in the planet. And all the different cultures of the world, the myriad cultures of the world, represent sort of unique facets of the human imagination and spirit. And together they envelop the planet and are as vital to the well-being of the planet as indeed is the biological web of life of which we hear so much. And just as the biological web of life is being eroded, so too are the voices of elders like the man that you met. So too are they being lost. And, of course, the erosion of the what we're calling it the National Geographic, the ethnosphere, is happening at a far more severe rate than the erosion of the biosphere. And you might define the ethnosphere as being the sum total of all thoughts and dreams and ideas and myths and beliefs brought into being by the human imagination since the dawn of consciousness. It's really humanity's legacy. It's the manifestation of what we have been as a wildly adaptive species. Now, no biologist would dare suggest that half of all species are moribund or on the brink of extinction, because it simply isn't true. And yet that, the most apocalyptic scenario in the realm of biological diversity, scarcely approaches what we know to be the most optimistic scenario in the realm of cultural diversity. And the reason that anthropologists and linguists focus so much on language is because language is the key kind of indicator of this terrible process of condensation. When we were born, Dick, there were 6,000 languages spoken on Earth. Now, a language isn't just a body of vocabulary or a set of grammatical principles. It's a flash of the human spirit. It's a vehicle through which the soul of each particular culture comes in the material world. I mean, every language, in a sense, is an old-growth forest of the mind or an ecosystem of thought, a watershed of the spirit.
But you're not talking about taking someone like yourself, going into a rainforest somewhere with several notebooks and just writing down as many of the words as we can with an acknowledgement that, yes, these people won't be here much longer, so we should at least get this down and then move on as a kind of a solution or an answer to this. That's not what you're saying.
No, chronicling the diversity of the human spirit won't do much for us. It's useful to do, but it won't do that much for us if we sit by passively and allow this process to continue. And the first thing to do is, of course, make people aware of the process. So of those 6,000 languages, as we sit here today, fully half are not being whispered into the ears of babies. They're not being taught to school children, which means that effectively, unless something changes, they're already dead. This means, in effect, that half of humanity's intellectual, spiritual lineage and legacy is being lost in a single generation, which is a rather astonishing thing. But there's a sense, even amongst those of us who are sympathetic to the plight of indigenous people, that these cultures are somehow failed attempts at modernity, as if they're destined to fade away, as if by some natural laws, their real world, which is ours, of course, moves inexorably forward. Well, these societies are not archaic, nor are they destined to fade away. It is not change that threatens the integrity of the ethnosphere. Every culture in every place of the planet has always been dealing with the one constant in history, which is change. All cultures are always constantly adapting to new possibilities for life. And it's not technology that threatens these cultures. A lot of people think it is. But, you know, a Sioux Indian didn't stop being a Sioux Indian when he gave up the bow and arrow any more than an American farmer stopped being an American farmer when he gave up the horse and buggy. It's neither change nor technology that threatens the integrity of culture and of ethnicity.
But it is in a place where the country, third world or first world, is cutting down the forest, cutting down the rainforest, taking away the place.
But there the issue isn't change, it's power. It's a crude face of domination. And what's sort of both discouraging and encouraging is that as you look around the world, two examples like you just mentioned, in every instance we can identify an external force which is overwhelming a people, you know, a people who can adapt to normal changes in life but cannot confront the sheer power of the state if it's imposed in a rather heavy-handed way. So whether it's a Penan in the forests of Borneo who, as you suggest, are suffering because their homeland has literally been cut from beneath them by egregious forestry practices, or whether it's the Ogoni in the delta of the Niger River who can no longer farm their once fertile soils because of the effluent of the petroleum industry, or indeed the Yanomami in the upper reaches of the Orinoco who suffer diseases previously unknown to the culture that have come in the wake of the gold miners who have swept into their territory. Or sometimes these interventions can be less explicitly nefarious or dark in a sense. They can be something like good intentions coming together with bad ideas in so much of the development processes that go on around the world, exemplified in a place like northern Kenya, where we sort of drag nomads from the land for the last generation only to spit them out of schools into a sea of humiliation that is spread around the city of Nairobi.
I want to back up a little bit before we get too far around the world to a part in the book where you talk about deciding yourself that you wanted to do something about this not far from here at the Peabody Museum, and I think you described the dusty halls and the waxen figures of the dioramas, because in one sense, whatever you saw in the Peabody Museum is explicitly what you don't want us to do or to embrace with the rest of the world.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we sometimes teach students, I think falsely, is that life is linear, Dick, and that it goes from A to B to C to D, and if you don't go through E to F, you don't get to G and H. Well, all of us who have lived a few years know that, in fact, life is made up of these marvelous serendipitous moments when, a crossroads is laid out before you. And what we really should be doing in teaching our children is to build within them the character to approach those crossroads with integrity and with a kind of a pure heart. And I've been blessed over the years to have a series of extraordinary mentors, one of whom was my anthropology professor at Harvard, David Mayberry Lewis, who was a man of searing intellect with a deeply humane heart and a kind of a power of the mind that was just awesome to behold. And I was very fortunate to fall under his influence very early on in my undergraduate education. And I think it was David who founded the incredibly important human rights organization Cultural Survival, who more than anyone else showed me the seeds of this idea that these cultures represent different ways of being, whole different manifestations of the human spirit. And I think that's really what's drawn me over the years, the curiosity of knowing the other. You know, perhaps I suffered from Baudelaire's malady, horror of home, but I always was seeking the other, some kind of understanding of who I was as a human being, which I think is one of the great kind of lessons of anthropology.
I was reading in the book about your exploration, your ethnobotany work that took you through South America, where I'm just looking for the name that the Inca gave to the coca leaf, the divine leaf?
The divine leaf of immortality. Well, you know, one of the things that I never quite understood as a young anthropologist was how I was expected to turn up at some village, perhaps of the Barasana in the northwest Amazon, of people of the Anaconda who believed that mythologically they came up the milk rivers from the east in sacred canoes, and people who cognitively do not distinguish the color green from the color blue because a canopy of the forest is equated to the canopy of the heavens. How was I to turn up in their village and sort of say, well, you know, folks, I'm here to study your lives. I'll be here for you. I mean, if someone like that came to our doorstep, we'd call the police. So you very early on, and one of the great sort of excitements of anthropology is discovering that way to break down the inherent barrier that exists by definition between yourself as an outsider and people with whom you find yourself living as a guest. And often finding that metaphor is really gives you the conduit to culture. So in many ways I became an ethnobotanist because I was traveling in South America, and obviously in the Amazon in particular, the people live by their plants, with their plants, because of their plants, and there is no better way to understand the life ways of the Amazon than to become a botanist. By contrast, if you want to work as I have in peoples like you first mentioned at the head of this program, Athabascan peoples of northern Canada, or the Inuit of the high Arctic, hunters of the northern ice. You know, botany is not going to get you a whole long way there. You know, there's some nice flowers, but you know, the key conduit to culture is the hunt itself. And if you want to study mythology, for example, there's no better way than to become a hunter, because the myths are an expression of the covenant that exists between predator and prey, and a way of the Inuit people or the Athabascan peoples rationalizing the terrible fact that for them to live, they must kill the thing they love most, the animals upon which they depend. I remember once I was working in northern British Columbia, and I met an old Gitxsan man, originally from the Skeena River, one of the Tsimshian language peoples, and I tried for several months to pry from his memory stories of the landscape that I knew for any number of reasons that he knew so well. And I finally gave up, and he said that all the myths were forgotten until one day one of our hunters, I had signed on as a big game hunting guide, and one of our hunters had killed a moose and taken the trophy and abandoned the carcass to the wolves. And I took my canoe on the float of our plane and landed at the kill and chased away a pack of wolves and then salvaged about 1,500 pounds of moose meat, and just as a gesture brought it down to this old man. And I'll never forget as he looked in the dusk, you know, as the sun set over that incredibly beautiful wild part of Canada, at this canoe full to the gunwales with moose meat, he suddenly said, as we went to get the horses to begin to drag it to the smokehouse to cure, he said, yeah, funny thing, I kind of remember now, I got a story for you. And that was the beginning of 30 years of recording the mythology of the Gitxsan people.
My guest is Wade Davis, and we're talking about a new book that he has out called Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. If you're interested in looking at some of the photographs that are through the book, they're on our website at theconnection.org. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about the stature, the status of the indigenous people, the aboriginal people that Wade has visited that are all around the world, and what they mean for our own survival. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is Wade Davis, who is Explorer in Residence, the proper name for your title with National Geographic?
Yes, it is. It sounds
it's kind
like
of a contradiction, isn't it?
Well, it sounds like an oxymoronic sinecure, yeah. But it's actually a wonderful program, and it's sort of the symbol, in a sense, of the new public face of the National Geographic, and the institution in general, at its 100th anniversary, decided that if in the first 100 years its mission was to tell you about the world, that now in the next 100 years of its existence, its mission will be to help you save the world. So my role as an anthropologist there, celebrating the wonder of the ethnosphere, is part of their recognition of the fact that cultural diversity needs to be approached and understood and protected as much as biological diversity.
I want to try and get to a closer understanding of that, and I wonder if I can ask you to read a little bit from your book. This is at a point when you're on the banks of the Amazon. Well, you set it up for me, this part.
Well, it's not a particularly lyrical passage, it's rather descriptive, but I was down in the Northwest Amazon with two remarkable men, the late Terence McKenna and his brother Dennis, who was a well-known phytochemist. And Dennis was trying to understand one of the great ethnobotanical mysteries of the Amazon, and that is the way in which indigenous people have found and combined some of their plants in rather remarkable ways. It's really the evidence, and I think the lesson here is that it's the evidence of sort of the genius of the shaman's alchemy and the notion that that genius comes out of a different way of seeing. So do you want me to read this whole passage?
Yeah, if you would.
Ayahuasca, which of course is the most powerful of all the psychoactive preparations of the shaman's repertoire. Ayahuasca, also known as yahe or capi, is a preparation derived from two species of Amazonian lianas, Banisteriopsis inebriens and, more commonly, Banisteriopsis capi. The potion is made in various ways, but long ago, the shaman of the Northwest Amazon discovered how to enhance the effects by adding a number of other plants. With the dexterity of a modern chemist, they recognized that different chemical compounds in relatively small concentrations may effectively potentiate one another. In the case of ayahuasca, some 21 admixtures have been identified, including most notably Psychotria viridis, a shrub in the coffee family, and Diplotheris cabriana, a forest liana closely related to ayahuasca. Unlike ayahuasca, both of these plants contain tryptamines. Now this is a quote from my friend Dennis McKenna. "The only way a tryptamine can be taken orally," Dennis explained, "is if it is taken with something that inhibits monoamine oxidase, the enzyme, in the stomach." And believe me, phytochemists actually speak like this. Amazingly enough, the beta-carbolines found in ayahuasca are precisely the kind of inhibitors necessary for the job. In other words, when the bark of the Banisteriopsis liana is combined with either the bark or leaves of these admixtures, the result is a powerful synergistic effect. The visions become brighter, and the blue and purple hues induced by Banisteriopsis alone are augmented by the full spectrum of the rainbow. "Now I ask you," Dennis said, "how on earth did they figure it out? What are the odds against finding in a forest of 50,000 species two plants, totally different, one a vine, the other a shrub, and then learning to combine them in such a precise way that their unique and highly unusual chemical properties complement each other perfectly to produce this amazing brew that dispatches a shaman to the stars? You tell me."
And Terence says a little bit later on that he doesn't think there is a scientific explanation for it.
Well, scientific explanations always come down to the great euphemism trial and error. But if you began to run the statistical model on that, you'd realize that it's kind of a meaningless euphemism that explains very little. Now, the shaman themselves will tell you that it's simple. The plants speak to them. And I was with a group called the Siona Sequoia once in the Northwest Amazon. And when my professor, Richard Evans Schultes, the late Amazonian explorer, first lived with the Sion in the 1940s, they identified for him 17 different varieties of this liana, Banisteriopsis capi. Now, to his highly trained Western eye, they were all referable to the same species. He could not distinguish one from the other. They could consistently do so, often at great distances in the forest. When he inquired as to the nature of their taxonomy, they turned to him and said, "Well, we thought you knew something about plants." It turned out, as they explained to him, that each of the 17 varieties, when taken on a full moon, sings to you in a different key. Now, that's a curious taxonomic system. It certainly wouldn't get you a PhD at Harvard, but it's a lot more interesting than counting stamens.
These people, this knowledge, the way that we are perhaps only just now learning to take advantage of that knowledge, that's like all looking in one direction. But if you took those shamans, if you took the children of that person out and had them at a university in Rio de Janeiro or Lord knows, at, you know, Harvard University. Does that then destroy what you're talking about in terms of trying to preserve whatever it is they have? Do you see what I mean?
No, I mean, this is this illusion that anthropology and anthropologists want to sequester indigenous people in some remote refugia, like some kind of biological specimen frozen in time. This goes against everything that anthropology is about. Anthropology studies the dance of culture through time, through space, through history. Just because you acquire technology, whether it's you learn to use the internet or whether you learn to use a camera, doesn't need imply the demise of ethnicity. In fact, it can be the empowerment of who you are. I just reviewed at the National Geographic an incredible new film, a 3-hour feature film called The Fast Runner, written, directed, shot, produced, distributed by the Inuit people of Nunavut, the new homeland in northern Canada. This is a film that has acquired awards throughout the world. It is an extraordinary piece of art, and that film did not imply the eradication or the erosion of the ethnicity of the Inuit people. Quite to the contrary, the very process of making it became a celebration of who they are as a people changing through time.
But if you take a remote village and you bring in electricity and you plunk down a television and you adjust the antenna and Baywatch comes on and all of a sudden people are sitting around watching that, trying to make sense of that language and that culture, and then being drawn away from what their other pursuits were prior to that, that's where it doesn't work.
No, and I think one of the key things here is that the whole development paradigm that has really been accepted as a given around the world has in fact been the spread of a particular modality of thought, which is a Western industrial way of being. And I think that it's
in English.
In English. I mean, it's worth pointing out that our species has been around for a million years. The Neolithic Revolution 10,000 years ago gave us agriculture. The industrial way of being is perhaps 200 years old, and that narrow, shallow history doesn't give me a great deal of confidence that this one way of thinking represents the full complement of our species' repertoire. And of course, the whole lesson of anthropology is that when all these different myriad cultures are asked the meaning of being human, they respond with 10,000 different voices. And it's within that diversity that we make up the human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us in the next few thousand years.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Wade Davis is my guest. We're going to Durham, North Carolina. Randy's calling in. Hi, Randy.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I've been following. I have a question for your guest, and you have a great show, by the way.
Thank you.
Early on, you mentioned that a change in technology would not deny the nature of being a Sioux, if I caught that correctly. Is that correct?
Not on the face of it.
On the face of it. And my question is involving, proselytizing religions, Islam, Christianity, et cetera. In your experience, how does that work into coming into a culture and denying their culture or co-opting their myths,
Or killing their myths in many cases.
Missionaries have gotten a very bad rap. The truth is that in many parts of the world, missionaries are, sad as it may sound to say, the lesser of many evils confronting these people. At mm-hmm. the same time, there is an inherent conceit in the spread of any religious ideology that assumes that you and your people alone have the monopoly on the route to God. What is a legitimate religion? Surely a legitimate religion, if we're at all humble, would be a religion that satisfies the spiritual needs of a people without doing harm. And, what I think this represents is not just the thrust of a religion overseas or outside of our confines of our own culture, but the inherent hubris of our own culture. And it's worth stepping back and thinking, turning the anthropological lens on ourselves, for example, and imagine yourself to be an anthropologist from Mars who comes to Earth. Now, if the measure of success was technological wizardry, we'd come out on top. But if the anthropologist was to look at, say, social structure, he'd have some questions about our way of being. I mean, he'd say, for example, that they say they honor marriage, but half their marriages end in divorce. They say they honor their elders, but only 6% of them in America, for example, are prepared to allow grandparents to live in the same home as grandchildren. They say they love their kids, but they embrace an obscene slogan like 24/7, implying, as it does, a complete abdication of familiar responsibilities, and then they're surprised to learn that the average American parent spends relatively less time with their children than, say, indigenous than occurs in indigenous societies throughout the world. So this is not to flog our society, but when you add to the mix our propensity to tear down the ancient forests, pollute the rivers, and compromise the biochemistry of the planet, you realize we are many wondrous things, but the paragon of humanity's potential we most assuredly are not.
Well, I agree with you. So you're pointing out elements of cognitive dissonance when you're saying we say one thing and do another. You know.
Well, I mean, every culture is ethnocentric, fiercely loyal to its own interpretation of reality. I mean, the word barbarian derives from the term barbarous, which the Greeks applied to anyone who babbled, anyone who didn't speak the language of the Greeks. So many indigenous peoples have their name for themselves to translate as the people, the implication being that other people beyond the frontiers of their culture are barbarians, savages at the gates of the known world or something. You know, I think that that's quite typical in human history, but certainly in the modern world, we can no longer indulge that kind of ethnocentricity.
Randy, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and to Newton, Massachusetts. Nelson's with us. Hi, Nelson.
Yes, I hate to be a party pooper, as you might say, by devil's advocate, but I wanted to bring up a point that perhaps ethnic diversity, language differences, religious differences are what has caused all the wars, people killing one another forever. Wouldn't it be better to all get together with one language and go on to Mars or Europa or do something interesting?
What language would you suggest that
English,
to be?
All towers throughout the world for aircraft and so forth have to speak English. So.
I don't know. How would you feel if you were a Yanomami and you didn't speak English and someone told you...
I wouldn't like it, no.
No, I don't think I would either.
No, but to avoid these wars, and we may have a final one that'll wipe everyone out, or most everyone.
But Nelson, don't we just start one big final war by saying, okay, all you people speaking with Australian accents that we can't understand in the United States, get your accents straight, get your farming practices in line.
Well, I think that by having this, as you say, all pervasive television throughout the world, we gradually do that, but not in a very good way, but I think it's sort of happening. But you must agree that this diversity, these differences have caused any number of wars and killings and deaths.
Well, I think there are death, misery, war through history has had all kinds of causes, some religious, some political, some ethnic. But I think we can look at this whole situation in quite a different way. If you look, for example, in the wake of 9/11, what was really going on there, we forget that so much of the thrust of Western development policy has had the effect in cultures throughout the world, not of elevating those cultures to our level of material well-being, which, for that to happen, as E.O. Wilson remarks in his new book, would require the resources of four planet Earths. Too often what we have is a people who are torn from their past, propelled into an uncertain future, and the very best they secure a place on the lowest rung of an economic ladder that goes nowhere. They're torn from their past, they drift to an uncertain future, and they fill the seas of humiliation that surround the cities of the world. And it's from those places that groups like the Al-Qaeda emerge.
Nelson, thanks for your call. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Boston. Alex is joining us. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
No problem. Great show. Now, I just wanted to relay my experiences. I was a remote teacher in Aboriginal Australia, and we basically would go into these remote communities and have educational programs. And I just wanted to relay my experience that there's hundreds of languages in Aboriginal Australia, and they're basically being phased out due to the educational regime that the Australian government has put forward because they teach in a pro-Western manner and basically ignore the cultural tenets of the people. people that they're trying to teach.
It is certainly cheaper to have simply one set of textbooks, but in the case that Alec's describing, Wade, where, you know, the government is saying about people who live far from hospitals and far from schools, well, let's take some education there. Is there a way of doing that which doesn't put the ethnographer's thumbscrews on that?
One would certainly hope so. I mean, Australia is a terrific example of that because, of course, it had 250 languages at the time of contact, and it still does have a huge number of languages, most of them spoken by a mere handful of people in each particular language group. You know, even some of the sacred cows of development, like literacy, you know, no one's allowed to challenge the idea that people should be kept from literacy, and I certainly would not do so, but we should still even look at what that can mean. If literacy implies, as it can mean in Australia, or it has meant in northern Kenya where I've done research, that nomadic people, for example, are taken from their families, put through a parochial school that involves a process of enculturation that subtly treats them to have, encourages them to have contempt for their past, and then spits them out the other end as clerks, as happens in Kenya. So you come in as a nomad, you learn a modicum of literacy, you go out as a clerk, and you enter an economy that has a 50 to 60% unemployment rate for high school graduates, and then, having been torn from your past, emerging as a mere shadow of your former self, you drift to Nairobi, and you enter these seas of humiliation. And there's one very important lesson, Dick, is that when human populations are squeezed, things happen. And in anthropology, these can be called revitalization movements. I mean, a perfect example would be the Boxer Rebellion in China. It wasn't just that the missionaries were killed or that they wanted simply to stop the opium trade or stop the Europeans from having access to China. When the missionaries were killed, their heads were cut off and the heads were put on pikes. It was a raw atavistic gesture that reflected the deep sense of humiliation of China, an ancient nation formerly the center of the world, now at the beck and call of barbarians at the gate. The Al-Qaeda is exactly that kind of revitalization movement, deserving to be expunged from the human record, but it behooves us to understand where they came from. And they invoke a kind of fantasy of a 7th century Islam that never existed, but has to be presumed to exist to rationalize their own humiliation, their own hatred, as they have seen their way of life increasingly affected, not by America per se, but by a model of development, by a Western idea.
Alex, just briefly, when you were in Australia, did you see yourself as contributing to this?
Well, actually, you know, in some ways I did, even though I was involved in a program that was created to counter it. It was a very good program called the Swirl Program, which is story writing in remote locations. It was started by Larry Mahone of Victoria University. But our goal was to visit these communities and have the children write stories that would be in English and also try to translate that into their indigenous language and then use these stories as literacy aids for children coming up through the ranks of school, other Aboriginal children.
Alex, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Wade Davis. His latest book is called Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is Wade Davis, and we're talking about his travels around the world and some of his thoughts as an... Is ethnographer right, or ethnologist? Do you,
well...
We figured that one out yet?
Yeah, I mean, anthropologist will do.
All right. And while the break was on, we were just chatting a little bit about a story in the book, Running the Boundaries in Peru, as an example of the sort of thing that you're able to get at and actually take something away that isn't just a collection of photographs, but a deeper understanding.
Well, one of the things that I try to make the point in the book is that these different cultures represent totally different realities, you know, and I try to bring up those examples from my own travels that sort of fill my eyes and ears with wonder, whether it's a jaguar shaman in the Amazon who can smell animal urine at 40 paces and tell you what species left it behind, or a Polynesian seafarer who can sense the presence of a distant atoll beyond the horizon simply by looking at the surface of the waves, or the Mazatec in Mexico who has something called whistle speech, which allows them to communicate in whistles across the vast expanses of their mountainous homeland. It's like a vocabulary based on the wind. Or, you know, when I went to Haiti, for example, you know, 8 years of traveling intermittently in South America, living with shaman, living in the forest, I never experienced what was available to me within 48 hours of arriving in Haiti, which was a window wide open to the mystic, you know, watching voodoo acolytes in a state of trance, handling burning embers with impunity. And it began to, you know, all these travels led me to think of the relationship between native people in particular and landscape. And we tend to either invoke Henry David Thoreau and suggest they're better conservationists than we are, or Rousseau and sort of say they're genetically closer to the land than we are, which is a kind of a silly idea. But indigenous people are neither sentimental nor weakened by nostalgia, but they forge through time and ritual a traditional mystique that's based on a far subtler intuition, and that's the idea that the world itself only exists because it's breathed into being by human consciousness. Now, what does that mean? It means that, for example, an Andean kid in the mountains of Peru, raised to believe that a mountain is the abode of an Apu spirit that will direct his or her destiny, will be a profoundly different human being than an American kid raised to believe a mountain is just a pile of raw rock ready to be mined. And I always love to participate in some of these rituals. And last February, I was able, in the village of Chinchero, just outside of Cusco, the imperial capital of the Inca, to participate in this wonderful event whereby it starts in the village, which was the site of the summer palace of Tocpa Inca Yupanqui, the second of the great Incan rulers. And believe me, they had the choice of real estate, and it's a stunningly beautiful valley. And what happens once each year is the fastest young boy in each hamlet dresses up head to toe as a woman and becomes known as a Wailaka. And the Wailaka, carrying the banners of the community, leads every able-bodied man on an incredible marathon. You start at 11,500 feet. You race down at a full run, 3,000 feet, to the base of the sacred mountain, Antakilka. You then storm up the flank of that mountain to a summit spur, perhaps a rise of 3,000 feet. Then you rush down the other side an equal distance, only to climb once more to a high pass. And it goes on like that for 25 kilometers around the perimeter of the community lands, a perimeter that's marked by holy mounds of earth where prayers are uttered and coca is given to the earth and the Wailakas dance. And what's fascinating about this is that the physical event is so arduous that by the end of the day, you almost have a sense of falling away into trance, emerging from the mountains less as a human being than as a spirit being who through ritual has reaffirmed your sense of belonging, your sense of place, your sense of community. And gestures like that create this dynamic relationship between peoples and their landscape. And that's why, for example, a quaggule from the forests of British Columbia, where I was raised, will be a different human being than myself. I was raised to believe that old-growth forest exists to be cut. He was raised to believe that it was the abode of Hukuk and the crooked beak of heaven and the cannel spirits of the north end of the world, you know. And so these metaphors make for a different people.
But were you allowed to go on this run with the...
Oh, yes, I did participate in the run, and I must say I only got through it by chewing more coca leaves than have ever been chewed in the 4,000-year history of the plants. It was unbelievably exhausting.
And did you have some of the experience, an element of the kind of fusion of spirit and body that,
well, mainly,
that they are doing?
Mainly in this incredible sense of
too much
the
coca.
Wonder of the wonder of community. You know, one of the things we forget in our society is that since the Enlightenment, we embarked on a great experiment in human social arrangements. We liberated the individual from the community. And that, as David Mabry Lewis once wrote, was a sociological equivalent of splitting the atom. We forget that in most places in the world, the community counts far more than the individual, because without that community, the individual will fall apart. And so that's one of the things you experience in these sorts of travels. And if you live with nomadic peoples, it's even more profoundly evident, because, for example, if we travel for a moment to the forests of Borneo and we live with the last nomads of Southeast Asia, the Penan, here in a nomadic society, a people of the forest, there is absolutely no incentive to accumulate material possessions because everything has to be carried on your back ultimately, and everybody can make everything, so there's no specialists. And so what is a measure of currency? What is the wealth of that society? Well, it turns out to be the strength of the social relationships amongst people, because, Dick, if you and I are two hunters with our families and you and I don't get along and we break up, by definition, each of our children will have a 50% chance less, a lower chance of getting food. So you see in these nomadic societies, adaptation playing off into patterns of life. Sharing becomes an involuntary reflex because you never know who will be the next to get the food.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Wade Davis, and we're going to Saranac Lake, New York, and Steve's joining us. Hello, Steve.
Hello. Hi. Hey, I want your job.
No, I'm sorry. Get in line behind me.
Right. Listen, it's about, like, relation with children. It's hard for me to phrase this, but the way they see their plants in the forest, the adults, you know, the shaman, and they talk to the plants are talking to them a certain way, and they're talking to us in terms of lumber, you know. And when they relate with children, their own children, are they hearing different things than we're hearing? Like, you sort of touched on, you know, we were developing our children a certain way, but we hear things from our children, and they say something, and we go, oh, you're being jealous, or you're being this or that. Are they hearing a completely different world from?
Well, they're not hearing different sounds. I mean, sounds exist in an objective sense. But,
don't mean that.
But the cult, yes.
The message.
Message is
like they don't hit their children, or do they hit their? Why would you hit a child?
Let me give you an example of one of the experiments that I've wanted to do with the internet. I'd love to put in touch one of my friends from the forest of Borneo. One of his children with, say, a child from Beverly Hills, and I'm going to ask two simple questions. First, I'm going to ask to name everything that you own, and the kid from the Penan, of course, will exhaust his list in about 3 seconds. The kid from Beverly Hills will take 4 months to get through her bedroom, and then I'm going to ask a follow-up question. How many hours today did you spend with your father? Well, the kid from the Penan will have no knowledge of what that question means, because by definition, he is with his parents all the time. That's how he lives. And the kid from Beverly Hills will be equally astonished at the question, because she'll say, hours a day? I think I saw my father last Tuesday. In other words, different choices that societies make for different human beings.
Steve?
In a different world almost with their children than we do with our children, almost.
All these different cultures live in a different world, and it's that range of worlds that I'm talking about. I mean, you know, my favorite anthropologists, Margaret Mead, once said before she died, was that her greatest nightmare was that as we drifted towards this blandly amorphous generic world, as we drifted from a polychromatic world of diversity to a monochromatic world of monotony, we would not only have the entire imagination of our species progressively reduced to a single way of thinking, a single modality of thought, but that we would wake one day as from a dream, having forgotten that there were other possibilities. And that, to me, was her nightmare, and that's, of course, what we're trying to talk about.
Steve, thanks a lot for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Your example of the internet and the ability to put those two questions strikes me, and maybe I'm going back to ground that we've already covered here, though, is the sort of thing where, do you think about that in theory, or do you actually think, you know, both sides would have something to learn by sort of calculated cross-pollination?
Well, in that case, as long as it could be set up in such a way that there wasn't an implicit kind of power relationship between, you know, the Beverly Hills kid and the kid in the Penang, I think it could be an extremely useful exercise. I mean, I maintain that the internet is a tremendous tool for liberation and empowerment. You know, there's again this conceit that these societies are delicate, precarious. These societies are constantly struggling with the challenges of life, constantly engaged in politics and trade encounters, and I think that actually one of the things that I, in my experience, has been incredibly helpful to imperiled societies is the realization that they're not alone, that the same forces that are confronting them, whether it's industrial intrusion or whether it's a political force or whether it's a criminal element like the cocaine cartel in Colombia or whether it's missionaries bringing in a new way of thinking, a new religious foundation to their lives, to realize that they're not alone is profoundly liberating, and to be connected to other indigenous peoples who are struggling for their own human rights, all of this can only help the preservation of the great diversity of the ethnosphere.
So for those of us who don't get a chance to go to the rainforest, for those of us who you know, can't explore the way you explore and interact and draw the wisdom from one place and try to make sense of it based on what you might have learned in another, give us a couple of tools. I mean, you're saying that we pride ourselves on being technologically superior, and yes, maybe we do succeed on that measure, but when it comes to how well we treat each other as neighbors, we don't do very well. How well we treasure the philosophical beliefs that are different within our own society, we don't do very well. But when you're talking in really broad terms about somehow embracing the 10,000 different voices who all chorus on what it takes to be a human, what can we do?
Well, I mean, I'll give you a couple of anecdotes. I have always been impressed at how unimpressed indigenous people are when they come to North America. You might think, for example, as I've done, that a young textile worker from southern Peru who's never been outside of her village and coming up at the age of 14 to Manhattan, that it might have impressed her. Well, in that case, this wonderful weaver who now has her own NGO, speaks fluent English, is versatile on the internet, is not leaving her culture, but in fact is empowering her culture and preserving the textile traditions of all southern Peru. Nilda Kalanalpa was brought up by a wonderful team of anthropologists, Ed and Chris Frankemont, in the 1970s, I guess it was, to Manhattan. Nothing impressive there but the wild squirrels in Central Park. You know, we brought some Penan people on a political kind of mission to the Americas during the height of our campaign to try to help them help themselves protect that forest homeland. And it was fascinating. Again, nothing in Vancouver impressed these three men who had never been outside of the forest virtually, except what did impress them were the homeless in the streets. Because, of course, we look at the homeless person as either lazy or an inevitable sad consequence of our economy, depending on our point of view and our ideology. But the Penan are taught to believe that a poor man shames us all, coming from a society in which sharing is an involuntary reflex. So they're in and of itself is a kind of a lesson. I mean, if you think, again, in terms of the overall history of humanity, you know, we have this cult of progress that we accept as a given in the affairs of human beings. But if you go back to your example of the Aboriginal people in Australia, I mean, have you ever thought of how it is that for 60,000 years those people have walked so lightly on the land? It's because they have a totally different cosmological, intellectual, spiritual sense of what land is. They actually live in two parallel universes, one of which we might call dream time, which is a misnomer because for us a dream is an abstraction. For them, the second reality really exists. And so when an Aboriginal person is walking the song lines, you know, walking the trajectory that the ancestors walked at the dawn of time when they sang the world into being, he's also seeing the world into being. So the rock at his feet exists in a phenomenological sense, but it's also constantly being born by his own imagination. It's a hard notion for us to understand, but it's very real for them. So how can you have a notion of improving upon nature when nature itself is constantly being created? It's in an act of creation. It's being born. So it's both there, but it's also still being established. So it creates a whole different relationship. And I think one of the lessons we can all learn from indigenous people is the value and the importance of metaphor. You know, when I say that the kid from Peru who believes a mountain is a spirit, as opposed to myself raised to believe it's a pile of rock, I'm not saying that I believe that spirit exists. At some level, it doesn't matter. What matters is the relationship between the child and the mountain who thinks that spirit exists.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Dick.
Wade Davis, ethnobotanist, anthropologist, National Geographic explorer in residence, and author of a new book called Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures. And you can take a look at some of Wade Davis's photographs on our website. We're at theconnection.org. And if you're in the Boston area, Wade will be reading from his work tonight at 7 o'clock at Wordsworth Books in Harvard Square. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.